There are some of my favorite books, like Norman MacLean's River Runs Through It, which concludes on the meditation as the father is talking to the surviving son. The brother has been killed, and he notes that it's those who we live with and know most intimately who somehow continue to elude us. And we even have some people who think we're finally strangers even to ourselves. So we ought to be wary of drawing too sharp a contrast between lovers and friends on the one hand and strangers on the other. But nonetheless, I think that some thinking and talking together about love and friendship makes a lot of sense in a summer where the theme is no longer strangers. The plan was this week, erotic love, next week, friendship. And I started this week by spending a first session entitled Strange Lovers, The Birth of Eros, looking at an ancient Greek text, section of Plato's Symposium, famous story there. And the next week, a kind of how to do it manual from the Middle Ages called The Art of Courtly Love. That was entitled Stranger Lovers, leading some people to wonder whether I'm Dr. Strangelove, really, rather than Dr. Swain. And the thought was that by examining those two very distant texts, we might get some perspective on our own day, some critical stance by which to view it, and also that we might be rather surprised by the continuities between these rather distant worlds and the world of our present day. And I thought I would just summarize a few of the things we learned, or at least explored on those 2 days before talking about the present scene. The work we looked at on Monday was a speech by the comic poet Aristophanes, in which he gave a speech in praise of love by telling a story, a kind of a myth, about the birth of Eros. And according to Aristophanes, to make a rather complicated and rich and very interesting story short, he said that human beings were, in the original state of things, whole and complete. In fact, they were circular. They don't look anything like we look like. They were circular beings, kind of like wheelies. In one of the Oz stories, there are people with four hands and four legs, and they wheel around. And they got too proud and tried to become like God, and the gods decided to split them in two. And there were three original beings, a male being springing from the sun, a female being springing from the earth, and an androgynous being springing from the moon. And so in the world of Greeks, the natural passions then, once these three beings were split, were first males for males, some females for females, and some males for females, because as soon as these beings were split, the first thing they wanted to do was to reunite, to find their other half, if you will, to embrace deeply and profoundly one another once more, and to return to the original state of wholeness or completeness. The story is more complicated, but I think what we learned was that for the Greeks, and we even suggested for the ancient Hebrews as well in the great Genesis stories, the primal longing that is eros or erotic is a longing that grows out of a kind of loneliness or a kind of sense of needy incompleteness, that human beings, having once been at some time whole, as a result of some cataclysm, became then incomplete and needy, and that Eros then in that story became the name for, according to Aristophanes, the desire for and the pursuit of wholeness, completion in the embrace of an other. Only very late in that myth does the issue of sexuality arise. And the people who attended that session, I asked at the beginning to just throw out some words that they associated with the word erotic, and we filled the bulletin board with words, about 80%, maybe 90% of which had to do with sex or sexuality or the physical. I think the word sensuality appeared, I think the word nudity appeared, adult movies appeared, fun appeared, sex appeared. And we noted that in the Greek story told by Aristophanes, sexuality arises very late in that story. It's not even mentioned early. And it comes about actually as a kind of remedy for another difficulty, because these folks, once they embrace one another passionately to be complete and whole again, don't want to let go. And so they die in each other's arms. They can't work. They can't eat, they can't sleep, they're clinging so desperately to each other, and human sexuality is introduced at that point in the narrative to provide a kind of release for people in one another's embrace, so that they can get about the daily tasks of life before re-embracing again at the end of each day. But anyway, in those worlds, the Greek and the Hebrew, we found that eros is one of the things much more profound and fundamental than simply sexuality, though sexuality is involved in the whole definition of eros. When we got to the Middle Ages, we entered a very different world indeed. Whereas the world of the Greeks was very much a homoerotic world, these were, after all, drunken men at a drinking party telling these stories and speeches to each other. The world of the medieval court, where courtly love arose, was relentlessly heterosexual. Clearly, courtly love, which was discussed in this book, had to do with the love of men for women and women for men. And we got right away in our Art of Courtly Love a definition. What is courtly love? And here I read it to you briefly. Love is a certain inborn suffering. Suffering derived from the sight of and excessive meditation upon the beauty of the opposite sex, which causes each one to wish above all things the embraces of the other, and by common desire to carry out all of love's precepts in the other's embrace. A suffering because the lover, once smitten by the sight of the beloved, begins to meditate on him or her. Indeed, this kind of eros, or this kind of romantic love, feeds on the imagination. People begin to then imagine all kinds of things, and this feeds their longings, powered by lust, until they're fearful that something will happen where their love won't be returned. And they straightaway set about finding an intermediary, according to this text, someone else, to go and talk, to find out how the other person really feels, and they become obsessed with nothing else but the thought of the beloved, and they do all kinds of silly and crazy things. Then, if their love is returned, they begin to fear that they will lose that love. So this kind of love is dogged with fear and uncertainty from the beginning and unto the very end. We learned, according to the courtly love tradition, that this kind of love thrives on obstacles. The more obstacles there are thrown in the path of the two lovers, the more difficult it is for them to see each other, the more their parents protest, the more deeply they become lovers. And we put a bunch of movies on the board before I read The Art of Courtly Love, people's favorite romantic movies. And again, 80 to 90% of them. We had West Side Story, we had Romeo and Juliet, I said a movie, a play, or a book. We had Dr. Zhivago. We had The English Patient. All of them feature lovers who have to overcome tremendous obstacles of class, sometimes of race, sometimes of geography, sometimes of family discord, as in Romeo and Juliet. And we found that, sure enough, these conventions, even in our present-day movies, are still very much with us, that romantic love feeds on things like jealousy and obstacles. And indeed, for the medieval writer in The Art of Courtly Love, the biggest obstacle was that one of the partners was married to someone else. So the model for fin amour, or fine love, became adulterous love. And the first romances, like Lancelot, some of you may have seen First Knight, about the 100th retelling of the Lancelot story, is the love of an unmarried man for a married woman. And so adulterous love became the kind of paradigm for the writer of The Art of Courtly Love for this kind of courtly passion, because after all, that was the ultimate obstacle. And so on. And we read, everybody laughed as I read, some nervously, some of the advice for lovers to how to keep their romance intense. And it was always things like, well, be apart from each other. Absence makes the heart grow fonder. Don't get used to one another. If you do that, love will wane. To keep love waxing, there have to be arguments, there have to be temporary estrangements, there have to be, again, more and more obstacles. So jealousy is the ultimate kind of nurse of love we read in this account, because as soon as you become jealous of someone else, as soon as you find your beloved desired by other people, she becomes or he becomes more desirable, etc., etc. Not altogether a pretty picture, I think. Suffering, jealousy, fear, but one that everybody seemed uneasily to recognize, until one person said at the very end that this seemed like not so much a definition of love as a definition of infatuation, or maybe even a definition of lust or horniness, I think the technical term was. And even went so far as to remark, another teacher of the middle school, that this reminded her, this description of courtly love, of the way middle school children behave. Secret love affairs, not telling anyone, finding intermediaries, passing notes in secret, giggling, being jealous, etc. And we had to end, since we were coming to an end of the period, on the note that it seemed as though we concluded in that period that American culture is still very much in the Middle Ages, and American adults are still very much in middle school. Okay, so that kind of brings those who are new up to date, and those who are regulars, helps to review where we've been. Now I want to take up a contemporary text, and I've asked especially some of the villagers who are presently college students, or at least college student age, to be with us, because this presumes to talk about them, and I was eager to see whether or not this talk about them is at all accurate. And so I'm going to read two excerpts that are brief, attempt to describe the condition of love and marriage today. Love and marriage today. And I want to mention one more thing for you to watch, and then I'll read these, and then we'll talk. The other night we had a wonderful forum on family, and Ingrid Christiansen, who was moderating, pointed to a book. She had purchased the last copy of it, called The Way We Never Were, and mentioned that this author talked about the uncoupling in our culture of several things that had once been held together, and they were marriage, love, childbearing, and childrearing. Now, if we add sex to that, sex, marriage, romantic love, childbearing, and childrearing, if we take those five, this kind of echoed a point we had made in our class about how you could take the history of erotic love through the West and notice how it had become progressively uncoupled from those other four things, and how the other four things had become uncoupled from one another. So that what had once been very much at the beginning, marriage for fundamentally procreation and for replenishing the next generation, then became marriage for companionship, and that now becomes marriage for who knows what, okay? And how those uncouplings that I mentioned, you'll notice, come through in these articles. But what I want you to do is to wear two hats as you listen. These are going to be short readings, but they're going to be punchy and direct. I want you first to think, are these readings accurate? Do they describe a state of affairs that you recognize, especially the folks in our midst in their 20s? And secondly, is this a state of affairs that, if you think it's accurate, that you think is basically an improvement over what really were, what you imagined to have been earlier states of affairs regarding human love? So here we go. The best point of entry into the very special world inhabited by today's students is the astonishing fact that they usually do not, in what were once called love affairs, say, "I love you," and almost never, "I'll always love you." One student told me that, of course, he says, "I love you" to girlfriends, quote, "when we are breaking up," unquote. It is the clean and easy break, no damage, no fault, at which they are adept. This is understood to be morality, respect for the other person's freedom. Perhaps young people do not say, "I love you," because they are honest. They do not experience love, too familiar with sex to confuse it with love, sometimes too preoccupied with their own fates to be victimized by love's mad self-forgetting, the last of the genuine fanaticisms. Then there is distaste for love's fatal historical baggage, sex roles, making women into possessions and objects without respect for their self-determination. Young people today are afraid of making commitments, and the point is that love is commitment, and much more. Commitment is a word invented in our modern times to signify what people believe to be the absence of any real motives in the soul for moral dedication. Commitment is gratuitous, motiveless, because people think that the real passions, the real erotic longings, are low and selfish. One may be sexually attracted, but that does not, or at least so young people think, provide a sufficient motive for real and lasting concern for others. Part of the inability to make sexual commitments results from an ideology of the feelings. Young people are always telling me such reasonable things about jealousy and possessiveness, and even their dreams about the future. But as to dreams about the future with a partner, they have almost not. That, they think, would be to impose a rigid authoritarian pattern on the future, which really they think should emerge spontaneously. This means that they can foresee no future, or that the one they would naturally foresee is forbidden them by current pieties. Similarly, why should a man or woman be jealous if his or her partner has sexual relations with someone else? A serious person today does not want to force the feelings of others. The same goes for possessiveness. When I hear such things, all so sensible and in harmony with liberal society, I feel that I'm in the presence of robots. Students do not date anymore. Dating was the skeleton of courtship. They live in herds or packs with no more sexual differentiation than any herds have when not in heat. Human beings can, of course, engage in sex anytime, but today there are none of the conventions that civilization had invented to take the place of heat, to guide mating, and perhaps to channel it. Nobody is sure who is to make the advances, whether there are to be a pursuer and a pursued, what the event is to mean. They have to improvise, for roles are banned, and a man, at least, pays a high price for misjudging his partner's attitude. The sex act sometimes takes place, but it does not separate the couple often from the flock, to which they immediately return as they were before, somewhat undifferentiated. Relationships, and not love affairs, are what young people have today. Love suggests something wonderful, a mad self-forgetting, exciting, positive, and firmly seated in the passions. Relationships, by contrast, are gray, amorphous, suggestive of a project, without given content, and very tentative. You work at a relationship, whereas love takes care, at least initially, of itself. In a relationship, the difficulties come first, and there is a search for common grounds. Love presents illusions of perfection to the imagination and is forgetful of all of the natural fissures in human connection. About relationship, there is ceaseless, anxious talk, the kind one cannot help overhearing in student hangouts or restaurants, except for those at Holden Village, between men and women who are, quote, involved with one another, unquote, the kind of prattle so marvelously captured in Woody Allen films. In one Nicholas and May bit, a couple who have just slept together for the first time assert with all the emptiness of doubt, it looks as though we're going to have a relationship. The reliance on relationships is a self-delusion because it is founded on an inner contradiction. Relations between the sexes have always been difficult, and that is why so much of our literature is about men and women quarreling. There is certainly legitimate ground to doubt their suitability for each other, given the spectrum of imaginable and actually existing relations between them, whether nature acted the stepmother, or God may have perhaps botched the creation by an afterthought, as some of the romantics actually believed. That man is not made to be alone is very well, but who is made to live with him? This is why men and women hesitated before marriage, and courtship was thought necessary to find out whether the couple was compatible, and perhaps to give them basic training in compatibility. No one wanted to be stuck forever with an impossible partner, but for all that, and here's the key difference, I think, for all that, people in the past knew pretty much what they wanted from one another. The question was whether they could get it. Our question today is much more, what is wanted? Let me read that again. The question in the past was, since people knew pretty much what they wanted, men from women, women from men, whether they would get what they wanted, whereas the question today is much more, what is wanted? And one paragraph from the other article that appeared last week, in previous generations, people chose to marry, but they were not compelled also to choose what marriage meant. Is it a sacrament, a covenant, or a contract based on calculation of mutual advantage? Is it properly founded on eros, friendship, or economic advantage? Is marriage a vehicle for personal fulfillment and private happiness, a vocation of mutual service, or a task to love the one whom it has been given to love? Are marital vows still binding promises that both are duty-bound to keep, or have they become rather quaint expressions of current hopes and predictions that, should they be mistaken, can easily be nullified? Okay, so in other words, the key concept underlying what he thinks is different today in terms of eros and that plugs into relationships and the whole bit is that the question today is what is wanted, not we know what we want and can we get from marriage. The question today is what is marriage? Rather than to know what it is and wonder whether one can succeed in it. People today have to define, according to these writers, the meaning of marriage, whereas for all of their problems in the past, men and women didn't have to do that. Okay? So those are two, I think you'll agree, rather provocative descriptions, and the floor is now open for people to challenge them, modify them, question them, and that's how we'll spend the rest of our time. Is this a right description of today's students?
I think we're being looked at, aren't we?
I want to hear from today's students first.
Well, I just completed my first year of college, and I think the difference between a relationship and a love affair is very true. And I come from St. Olaf College, which is profound and infamous for its non-dating scene. Kids at St. Olaf hang out is the term. But I think that's true, is that there aren't love affairs and there aren't illusions of or that bliss that we hear in these romantic, stories that we grew up on that we heard from. There's more relationships and there's gray areas and well, what do I do now? And what does she want? What does he want? And we kind of work through them and there's not as much commitment because we're still building it. Whereas I think a love affair is true. It's this feeling, it's this mentality, this emotion that you want to be with that person all the time, and it doesn't matter what there is or what's standing in the way. It's that emotion. I think that's gone, at least in my experience. I can't really speak to
that. I also think that the way courtly love is envisioned, it tends to be more static. This is how I feel. We're always going to feel exactly this way. Whereas today, it's from at least my experience and my talking to other friends and stuff, it's much more, it's evolving. You never know exactly how things are going to change, but it doesn't have the constancy. And sometimes it gets bigger, sometimes smaller, but it always seems to be evolving, moving in one direction or another.
Yeah. To what Adam said, I think that bliss does still exist. I think it's probably just harder to find, because I know people who are happy, and I observe people who are in that bliss, and I think just typically it's not as common as it has been, but it's out there. I don't think it's dead.
When someone runs back to the corridor or wherever one lives these days in residence halls and says, I just am in love, I can't get him or her out of my mind. I have reorchestrated my entire schedule to catch sight of her at his home. Do the rest of the people, upon hearing this, quietly believe the person is nuts and kind of ought to kind of come as quickly as possible to their senses? Or do they sort of celebrate the fact that the person is in that state of mind?
I know, like, as far as, like, some of my friends have been like that, and, like, the first day they say that, you're happy for them, and you're like, that's great, but when they talk about this person 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, she just gets old, you know? You might as well go out with this person, you know so much about them. So I don't think that's, like, love anymore, that's just, like,
infatuation.
Somebody.
Mm-hmm. But inside, you're really happy for them.
Yeah.
You know, but in your way, you're like, okay, where's mine? type thing, but...
I think I'm kind of cynical when I hear that from friends, knowing that really it's not really going to last, because I kind of agree with Adam with the relationship.
That is that part of the that I read about relationships today did resonate as it did with him as mm-hmm. being kind of the scene, so to speak.
Yeah.
Anybody else want to add anything to this? I have a follow-up question to this, but on the relationships. Yes?
I've been thinking about this lately, and it seems like, just from what you said, the last little part that you wrote twice, it really made me kind of rethink. And it seems like we don't need marriage like we used to. Like, we used to need, like, now what we need in our lives, what I see in the future, is like exploration of my personal philosophy, traveling around, finding new things. There's so many options. And what I see marriage as what it has been is kind of a survival thing, in a way. Like two people getting together and saying, okay, we are going to make this work, we're going to make our lives work. And I don't see that as something that people need anymore all the time. Like, a lot of times there's more of an emphasis on getting out there and getting as many experiences as you can rather than settling down and just surviving.
Okay, let's hear from some of the married folks on that, dude.
I'm in my second marriage, and I'm 34. And I see marriage very differently. I don't see it as, I could get along very well by myself, and so could my wife. But I think we have seen a value in sharing ourselves at the greatest extent with another human being that you never get when you're just in the crowd or dating or whatever that's called.
I've done a lot of reading lately.
This one book, I guess, specifically. The fourth turning. But he says that people today are still getting married, but they're getting married later and later. And so part of it might be that we as youth are staying selfish, searching for our own independence, our own philosophies, our own experiences for a longer time before we're willing to share those experiences. And so that at the age of 21, I'm still in a selfish kind of mode where I want to figure out who I am before I'm willing to share that with someone else.
Yeah, that makes sense, because my mom was married at 22, you know. I mean, kids now that are 21, 22 have no intentions of getting married, like, anytime soon, you know. They're still out there looking around. And so.
I would say that you're being very wise. And this is my husband. And it's the second marriage for me. And I was engaged when I was 19 and married when I was 21. And I wish I never, ever, ever, ever would have done it. I think... I think waiting and exploring and learning about yourself, learning about relationships, learning about other people, I think is very, very wise. I wish I could have, I would have done the same thing. I really do. Mm-hmm.
I think our generation might be a little skeptical, too, of love and marriage, just as the course of, that our culture has taken.
And basically skeptical of the notion that love and marriage can go together, or of both of them separately?
Well, skeptical that it will ever last, you know. So why, you know, you might be in a relationship with a person forever, expecting it to not last.
Yeah.
So why go through the marriage?
Okay, yes.
But I think that you know, that not knowing what it is really true. I think of how many conversations I have with particularly with women, of course, of my age in the early 40s, in which we talk about our marriages, about as making it up. How does this work? This isn't the relationship our parents had. I don't think that our parents who were married in the early 50s were living out of a courtly love tradition. They had a much more prosaic view of what marriage was about, the different expectations. And in some ways, that's a useful experience to look at, and in some ways, it's not. And so that phrase rings in my mind. We're making this up, trying to figure out what it is we're supposed to do and then how you do it. Mm-hmm. Or supposed to is the wrong word. What it is we want to do and then how to make it work. I think it's accurate, not just about people in their 20s, but 30s, 40s, 50s.
Mm-hmm. We ended the class the last time on Tuesday by thinking some, as I summarized it kind of humorously, but I think accurately, as though many adults today are stuck in middle school. When we looked at the mythos that still really catches people in these films, like The English Patient and Dr. Zhivago and so on, Romeo and Juliet, people were very wary of thinking that that kind of passion is the one that ought to feed into a marriage, number one. And number two, they really wondered whether or not jealousy, the class was, not exactly like the robots that this writer describes, but certainly wary of a passion that fed on jealousy. Maybe it's true that people seek relationships and hang around in herds and so forth and so on because they're rightly wary about that kind of courtly love or fin d'amour or whatever. They may enjoy it in The English Patient, but they're wary about it in real life. And so maybe we should say that it's an advance, what he takes to be a kind of sad thing about today's young people, that they have relationships, that they can't commit, that they hang around in herds, that they don't know what things mean, that they enter into things very late if they're going to be really long-term. Maybe that shows a kind of wisdom. I'm wondering whether or not, again, to hear from especially the students, you think that that does reflect a wisdom, or are you like the writer and think it's kind of, the scene is kind of empty, or at least it's not as rich and thrilling and wonderful as it might be if more people, instead of the minority you mentioned, really had fallen in love and were having love affairs rather than relationships?
Well, one generation's wisdom is another's folly. I think that this...
Write that down.
I think what we're experiencing, I think our parents, what we watch our parents go through, what is it, 49% of divorces are gone, or marriages are done in 6 years, and who knows what the rest are done, you know? And we see brothers and sisters having out of wedlock marriages. Maybe we're having out of wedlock marriage, or out of births ourselves. We see nothing lasting, and I think that's what Jeremy was saying. You know, it's not a matter of what we want. It's a matter of we're not skeptical. Even if we know what we want, but we're pretty sure it's not going to last. So we could spend forever thinking it's not going to last. And so I think that our generation is seeing that, whereas another generation, maybe the older generations, so saw it a little differently. I think we're just reacting to what we see.
I think it's a skepticism, but also a pragmatism that says, I'm going to go and I'm going to hit it on my own, and eventually, yeah, I'm going to want to have kids. But both kids and a wife, or kids and a husband, like at this point, are going to tie me down, and there's things I want to do. At some point, yes, I want that. I want that security. I want that safety. I want to share. But not now. And so the skepticism, I think, is mixed with a sense of, let's do this in the right order.
Mm-hmm. Well, also, I mean, Adam was talking about, you know, seeing this happen to other people, but I was talking to my best friend who was up here, you know, a week ago, and we were talking about relationships and stuff, and both of us have, in some sense, kind of gotten burned by, I mean, like, our parents have gotten divorced or whatever, and so we felt the impact of that and had to live our lives based on the fact that they entered into something too early or something happened where something went wrong. And so, of course, we're going to be, that's one big reason why we're really cautious about making huge commitments or something, because we don't want to hurt, you know, a child for sure, and, you know, try to protect ourselves too from getting hurt in a way that our parents and we ourselves were hurt.
What I see today is that we're scared, basically. I mean, or wary just of the whole relationship, courtship, motions or whatever. If you're in a larger group, if you move around in a herd, you have like that whole safety blanket. You don't have to spend all your time with that person. You can kind of go over and talk to them, or you have other people to play off of. It isn't a one-on-one thing. There's much to risk when it's just you and them. So we're just kind of figuring out how to do it. Yeah.
So it's wariness and maybe even in some cases a little cowardice.
I think that we're really discouraged, like especially at my age, I just graduated from high school, from having like those relationships where it's just infatuation, like changing your schedule around so that you see them every minute and stuff, because I mean, all of us are changing a lot right now in our lives, and we don't know if whoever that we're going to be with is going to change with us, and so it's more, I don't know, it's more beneficial to us so we don't get as hurt in the future when we have relationships where we, like, grow together instead of just, like, being together so that, you know, the relationship changes instead of just us moving in different directions, I guess.
I hear you. Can we hear from some of the folks who are next generation up as to what they make of what you're hearing, both in what I read and what the young folks here are saying back in the corner there?
Well, what the young folks are saying makes a whole lot of sense to me. And I was thinking that they have a much longer life expectancy, which is maybe part of this. But also, how do I reconcile their wisdom with what I think is a high incident of birth of young children, and they're separate issues in some ways, and in other ways they're connected. You know, with waiting longer, sure, that makes sense, but is this a sort of a special group here, or what you're reading about? Because I think in the mainstream of like America or inner cities, is that representative? I don't know.
Right, we may be talking, and this writer certainly was, about people who were college educated or beyond. I mean, so there was a certain education and class level that probably, you're right to remind us, may not apply, and probably just does not apply uniformly across lines of class and ethnicity and so on, and education. Yes?
Yeah. I think the particular group that one is, like college age over, As a pastor, at least the people that I have coming to me for marriage are often two different groups. One is about the ages between 17 and 19, and the other group then will start in about age 27 and up. And much of the opinion here is the kind of opinion expressed by those folks who are 27 and up. And for them, I think marriage finally becomes a matter of pragmatics. Obviously, they're not getting married because of sex or anything like that, because often they've been living together for 3, 4, 7 years sometimes. But one of the primary reasons, and often the woman will say this, is that the biological clock is ticking, and now it's time to have a child. And when they're ready for children, it seems that marriage then becomes still the best structure in which they think raising a child should happen. And they take a very pragmatic view on that's why they want to get married. Mm.
Very interesting. Well, let me try this tack to provoke you into further thinking. Tomorrow is the 4th, and we're having big festivities, and we're celebrating Independence Day. Much of what I've heard throughout the week and even tonight is that as old as American apple pie, the quest for the American freedom, which is also bound up often with individualism. People are saying things to me that sound kind of like this. Look, the Greeks, with their stories, first you're half and you can only be whole in the arms of another, are kind of true, but really what we've learned as a culture is that before we enter into something like a love affair, we really need to be whole by ourselves. We are very wary of the notion that our wholeness comes in the arms of an other or even in the arms of others. We are finally the last generation of the rugged individualists who would like first to have a couple of degrees, a career decided, about $50,000 in the bank, probably a car, probably have been through 4 or 5 trial relationships, and basically have arrived at a point where we can make it on our own. We are self-sufficient, whole, independent, free agents, and now, at age 35 to 40, now we're ready to meet another self-sufficient, independent, free agent who's fully formed and needs no one. And on pragmatic grounds, decide to warily enter into some kind of mutual, equal relationship, let's call it a marriage. The problem being that, although that sounds very good and certainly avoids some of the errors others made entering into this before they were fully formed and finding out things didn't work, now people are so self-sufficient, independent, and have convinced themselves they don't really need someone else because they are complete unto themselves, enter into something like an empty contract, and at the first sign that it's not working out, that's where we get our 49%. So that what we have as a problem entering into Independence Day is that we're so enamored of independence and self-sufficiency that we should pay a little more attention to the myth of Aristophanes, who suggests that really our fundamental condition is neediness and incompletion, and that basically we may as well acknowledge that and have love affairs sooner or later and take those risks rather than entertain the delusion that we can ever be whole and complete by ourselves. What about that hypothesis, a kind of challenge to the Independence Day ethos here? Anybody buy this, or am I a nut?
I buy it.
Yes. Back here.
Me?
Yes.
Okay. I feel like you just described something I've been thinking about for a long time. It's really weird. I've been dating someone for 2 years, and sometimes I feel like we have a great relationship. Being committed to each other is really great, and we should just get married. We're going to graduate from college next year. You know, it's the time everyone sort of runs to each other and gets married. But on the other hand, I feel this intense need for this independence thing. And I feel this, like, if I could only hold off this relationship for 10 years and sort of push it aside and then completely form the whole person that you're describing. And it's really weird. I can't reconcile this with myself. I just feel absolutely torn by it. It's a little bit odd, I think. And so maybe I'm nuts too.
Well, I think you're caught in the crossfires of our culture. You're just sort of picking up in your own soul the mixed messages of our culture. A longing for commitment, a longing for mutuality and love, and yet a fierce determination to be independent, self-sufficient, and whole by ourselves first. And those things are really at cross purposes often. And I think, open up the space for the discourse of a community like this, which has a much richer vocabulary of community and belonging, and that unembarrassingly says how deeply we need each other in Christ. So I mean, I think that that kind of dilemma that you feel is very much the dilemma of our time.
That dilemma that you talk about, I'm a divorce lawyer, and I've done hundreds, probably actually I've done thousands of cases involving divorced families. And what happens is they want something from the relationship, but they're not clear what it is, but they'll marry. And then they'll figure it out and then go for their independence after 5 years or 10 years. You know, one might want a relationship, an intimacy, and then figure out, oh, this was nice, but I can get a better model now. Or they wanted financial security. This was nice, but now I don't have to make money, so I go somewhere else. So I think that's why the marriages, the lengths of marriages and the frequency of divorce at a certain time frame is because of the, okay, what I came in with, my agenda, hidden most times, I can now fulfill outside the marriage, so I might as well.
Yes.
I feel really strongly that you need to be independent before you can really fully enjoy some type of a relationship. That you're not entering a relationship hoping that will fulfill a need, or hoping, oh, this person is exactly what I've been looking for. This person will make me the person I've always wanted to be, because that might not happen. And that's always been true with me. And when I finally had reached that stage where I was totally fine on my own and had embraced singleness to its fullest, and I met someone and fell in love, and it's been a pretty long-term relationship now, and we're talking more long-term to this day, pretty much. And I think I've been able to enjoy the relationship because when I met her, she was not really making me feel like, oh, this is the person I need to be, but she was this amazing addition, kind of, that a whole another extra wonderful thing.
So she swept you off your feet?
Oh, yeah.
Love still happens.
I think that mentality is kind of something that our generation has grown up with. When I was growing up through junior high, high school, my dad always told me that you date more to find out more about yourself than anything else. I mean, that's kind of the mentality I guess I've held on to. But I agree that I think, like, if you go in looking for something in a relationship, for one thing, and if you commit your whole life to this person, and then that thing is filled, and you realize that you filled this thing without this person, then where are you?
I also feel this is just kind of a whole another perspective, but I mean, in some ways, I think I'm a feminist, and historically, you know, women have had to depend on marriage or whatever for their identity. And so I feel like now it's like I'm in the part of, I mean, there's been generations before me, but I mean, I'm for sure part of the generation that has this opportunity to finally become independent, to do our own thing, to travel if we want to, and not to have to get married to, you know, have a family or to have a life, you know. I can have a life of my own. And so in a way, like, looking back on all the women who didn't have the opportunity that I do, I feel like, I mean, I should use that opportunity too, you know. I don't know.
Okay. So I think part of what we have to recognize is that not only the feminist movement and a lot of other social movements, but a certain kind of, we're at an unusual, tiny 1% of 1% of human history that has that kind of abundance and set of opportunities open also. I mean, that just hasn't been the characteristic feature of world history, nor is it the characteristic situation on the globe today either. So we have to remember that economic and social conditions underlie these views that we're throwing out, yes.
I guess what's most disconcerting to me in this conversation, it began earlier when they talked about their skepticism about long-term commitments. That matched with the whole idea of independence. I mean, I think primarily, at the root of it, marriage is about commitment. Right. Commitment to someone else, not commitment to my independence. Okay. And it requires my ability not to be skeptical about commitment. I mean, marriage is my commitment. I will be married to my wife because that's what I decided I'm going to do. We've made that commitment to one another. And so my happiness, my fulfillment, my needs, my current state of love, or whatever I want to define that as, has to be secondary to that commitment, or else we end up with the 50% divorce rate. And I'm not blaming you. I understand where you're coming from, but that's very disconcerting to me. And I understand why you are so skeptical about commitment, but I find that frightening, or sad. I'm more sad than I am frightened by it.
Yes.
Two things. I'm a little bit confused about this myth of independence occurring somewhere around 30 to 35 years old. One observation. Perhaps I'm strange. The other thing that's bothering me a little bit is, as this conversation is evolving, is that somehow marriage and independence are mutually exclusive each other, that they cannot exist at the same time. And that concept to me is, I guess I find it contrary to that. There is a commitment, there's a union, and certainly there's compromise in any marriage. But to think that there is no room for independence within a marriage is a little bit disturbing.
Thank you. So we shouldn't set up these things as too much intention. They can be complementary, and maybe even complementary such that one is most fully independent within a larger framework like marriage. Thank you. Yes.
I'm hesitant to say anything because these kids could be my grandkids. These young people, I should say. But I have missed one thing in all of this discussion of marriage, and that is the marriage truly is the giving of love, not the taking away of anything, but my giving my love, and my wife, who has been my wife, my first wife, for 48 years, 49 years. But the thing is, we have independence. She's had a career of her own, I've had my own career. I was 25 when we got married. I had been in the Air Force and flying, and she was still at the university. But we've had our individual lives, and we've shared our individual lives. She shared her individual life with me and mine with hers. And we have grown from erotic love to continued passionate love to deep friendship to companionship and continued passionate love. And it isn't something that I have not lost anything by the blessing that the Lord gave me with my wife, but I have found much more than I had ever had before.
Thank you very much. That I'm going to make that be, because I don't think we can muster similar eloquence from at least me, the last word. I'll just give you a little preview of next week in a footnote to this conversation. Next week we will turn to a different kind of love, the kind of love that you mentioned your own marriage evolved into including, and that is friendship. And we will talk on Monday about friendship, and we will see then on Monday night a film, When Harry Met Sally, about friendships between men and women and whether these are possible. And then we will move toward the end of the week to agape, another kind of love, because I think in getting to your notion of self-giving love, we are coming up there against one of the great critiques that was ever written. Two great critiques of Eros as involved fundamentally in marriage, and those are Anders Nygren's great book, Eros and Agape, and a great book, I think, called Love in the Western World, in which basically the author says What we need to recover is a sense of the creative potential in promise making, that self-giving love risks, expends itself, and finally begins to create a new reality. And that if you're going to wait to make a promise until you can make it an accurate prediction or a careful calculation of probability, then you may be waiting for a lifetime. In other words, there's a kind of risk undertaken in the context of Christian marriage that can indeed be and has been for many people, and I suspect that we have a witness of a couple of them for whom it's been that, a great creative blessing. That there are just possibilities, individual possibilities, to pick up on your theme, that could never have been realized had these two people not been joined together in marriage through a kind of promise that was a risk and undertaken in the context of a different kind of love. A love that finally can transform the world, which it's doubtful that Eros bound up as it is finally with obstacles and a kind of death wish. I mean, if it thrives on absences, the ultimate absence is death. So its twin has always been a kind of dark side. And even friendship, which however rich that may be, we'll discover next week, may not be adequate to bear the kind of strains that the institution of marriage has been asked to bear in our time. And so hopefully by the end of next week, we'll have gathered up some of the issues and difficulties and dilemmas and struggles that you've all articulated, and get some even newer perspectives on those that are consistent with the Holden team. But I want to thank all of you for your candor and your insights and your attentiveness, because I think this has made it a really great experience for me to learn so much. So thank you, and we'll see you